Hey, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to this week's message. My name's Aaron, and I'm on the staff team here at Eastlake. Everything we do around here depends on the generous donations of our local and online community, people just like you, who tune into these messages and see great benefit from living that idea that life is a gift and love is the point. So if you love what Eastlake is up to, we'd encourage you to contribute by going to eastlakecc.com. With that, let's jump into this week's message. Today, we hear from Sarah Hansen as she continues our Enneagram series, Nine Paths to Wholeness, speaking from the perspective of an Enneagram 6.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Eastlake via webcams. This is just such a crazy time, and I'm so happy to still get to share with you this morning, but I also just recognize that we're in such a weird time of life, in our nation and in the world. I hope that you are safe and healthy, tuning in from wherever you are. Currently, my husband has our three children in a minivan, just driving around blocks, maybe hitting up some drive-thrus. So blessings to Darren. My name is Sarah. I live here in Bothell, Washington with my husband, Darren, and three children, Hope, Dylan, and River. And I've been going to Eastlake actually for about 11 years. We are currently in a series called The Nine Paths to Wholeness, where we're exploring all the nine types of the Enneagram. We've gotten to hear from five really incredible people, and hopefully you've gotten to tune into those. And so today I get to share with you what it's like to identify with the type six, and obviously from my own perspective. So the first time I heard about Enneagram was definitely from Eastlake. And true to my nature, I was very skeptical, if not actually fearful, of what this thing was, and feeling like maybe it was probably demonic, things like that. And thankfully, I actually leaned in and researched and did my own reading and talked to a lot of people about it and found it is actually a great tool and so helpful. And I would say that Darren and I often reference it throughout the day. It has given us a shared language in our marriage and also increased our empathy and insight for each other. So I would encourage you, if you're not as familiar with it, it's okay. I think it's okay to dive in a little bit and see what you find out. I'd like to start with a quote from Russ Hudson about the six. He says this: "No matter what we say about sixes, the opposite is often also true. They are both strong and weak, fearful and courageous, trusting and distrusting, defenders and provokers, sweet and sour, aggressive and passive, bullies and weaklings, on the defensive and on the offensive, thinkers and doers, group people and soloists, believers and doubters, cooperative and obstructionistic, tender and mean, generous and petty, and on. It is the contradictory picture that is the characteristic fingerprint of sixes, the fact that they are a bundle of opposites." From that, you can obviously imagine that it has been hard to figure out how to write down and get down all my thoughts on what it's like to be a six, because I would write down one thing, and then I would think, you know what, the opposite of this is also true, or I could think of examples where the opposite was true. So it made it hard to get something down on paper that felt like, okay, yes, this is what it is. I had a lot of self-doubt of like, do I even know enough about the Enneagram? Do I even know what I'm experiencing? And am I even a six? So true actually to the nature of a six, it was hard to do it, and figure out how to make it true, not only for me, but I wanted to hopefully be relatable to other sixes. So I did a smart thing. I asked other sixes, just a few of my friends, of what it was like for them during this time and during this whole the coronavirus time in our lives, of what it was like to be a six. So I'll be interweaving some of what they said throughout the talk. And it was actually very helpful, even just to know that I was on the right page. So let me give you a little brief overview. Some of the key words or terms that are typically used in describing the six. So we are the committed, security-oriented types. We're engaging, responsible, anxious, and suspicious. We are hardworking. We tend to be very funny. A lot of stand-up comedians, I would like to add, are sixes. We are loyal. We like to say that we're a realist rather than pessimistic. We tend to take on too much responsibility. And yes, we can be moody. So some of the names associated with this type are the loyalist, the trooper, the devil's advocate, and the guardian. Our basic fear is being without support and guidance. And our basic desire, or you would say our need, is to have security and support or even a sense of certainty. The Enneagram 6 with a 5 wing is kind of known as the defender. And the Enneagram 6 with a 7 wing is the buddy. And so we kind of sit right in the middle of that, of the intelligence center of the head, which is interesting. So this morning I'm going to focus on 3 aspects of the 6, and I'm going to finish up with a short story. So number 1, though I didn't want the whole talk to be about fear and anxiety, it's a lot of it is going to be because it's such a true part of what it means to be a 6. Though I think, to be fair, every 6 probably experiences fear and worry or anxiety in a different way. And so I tend to use the word anxiety, but you might use the word worry or fear or things like that. So just know, I think for everyone, for every 6, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have like a clinical version of anxiety. It could just mean that they have worries that they deal with on a daily basis. So I can map out my life chronologically by what I was afraid of at different times. And it goes like this: robbers, the dark, fires, sleeping alone in a room by myself, parents getting divorced or dying, kidnappers. And this one lasted a very long time until one day my younger sister informed me that I could not be kidnapped anymore because I was in fact an adult. And so I quickly changed it to abduction, which is the adult version of being kidnapped, which then meant I was afraid to go on a bus. For some reason, public transportation was where I thought all abductions took place. Then that led to internal combustion was around this time, and I would just lie in bed kind of waiting to erupt into flames. I've been afraid of flying, sleeping alone in a house by myself. And then at 22 years old, I remember exactly where we were driving. That same younger sister, I should add, we were driving and I looked at her and I said, I just have something like so terrible to tell you. She's like, what is it? And I was like, you are going to die. Like, we are going to die. And she looked at me and kind of laughed, not at me, but just because, she's a 7. So you'll get to hear more about her next week. Her response was, yes, I know that. And somehow it was so comforting to know that I hadn't surprised her with my recent existential crisis. The fear of death for me has been different from all the other fears because the other ones I could figure out how to control, even if it was my own perception of what that meant. But death is totally unknown. You can't plan for it. You can't control it. And for me, it's always in the back of my head. And it's like the last thing I think of before I fall asleep. And typically, even sometimes the first thing I think of when I wake up. It was very comforting to know that I was not alone in my struggle with fear. So here are some quotes from the other 6s, and some of which are specifically referring to the coronavirus. This person said, I hate that fear has played such a large role in my life, especially being male and dealing with fear has been a lifelong struggle. It seems culturally acceptable for a girl or woman to be afraid of something, but embarrassing for a boy or a man to be afraid of the same thing. When I was younger and even now, hiding my fears can result in acting defensive, when what I'm really doing is trying to hide what I don't want someone to find out, which is that I'm afraid. So in regards to the coronavirus, this person said, the insatiable need for information fuels my anxiety, but I can't stop myself because of my need to be prepared. You better believe I was stocked up on freezer food and toilet paper before the frenzy started, and I was and still am reading many news articles daily. During this time, this is another one. During this time of the coronavirus, of course, there is a fear of the virus itself, but I am almost more fearful of the supply chain issues from others hoarding. The thought of not having enough in the stores for my family is anxiety producing. So something unique about the six is that we have two kind of subtypes, or what some people have called pivots. And you might have heard of them before, but it's the phobic and the counterphobic six. And Chris Hewerts actually thinks that perhaps all of the nine types have this type of, two subtypes below them. But for the six, it's probably the most well-known to have these two. So the phobic six is a person that would move away from their source of fear, or even become, in their response to fear, would have that freeze response, where the counterphobic presses into whatever it is they're afraid of as a means to overcoming it. So as you can imagine, those two would look really different in a situation, even if they're both sixes, depending if they're responding phobically or counterphobically. My hunch, as I've been exploring the Enneagram, I don't feel like I'm one or the other. And it was very comforting to know that actually Father Richard Rohr agrees that perhaps it's more of it depends on the situation or what's coming up, that you might actually respond as a six, one day or in one situation with a more counterphobic reaction, and the other day maybe more phobic. And what's interesting is this is where sometimes a six can get mistyped as an eight because of that counterphobic reaction, which is really strong, and it even can be aggressive. And so if you have ever, people have ever thought, oh, maybe you're an eight, it could be that you at times react with that counterphobic reaction, which is really strong. And I think a cool thing. So number two is I look for safety and security outside of myself. I need others to help me feel like everything will be okay and that I'm safe. This especially is true on an airplane. It matters greatly to me that the initial message that you hear from a pilot when you first sit down, I'm like ready for it with my headphones off and like waiting, because if he or she gets on and like makes a joke, tells me to sit back and relax, like, oh, smooth sailing, and they just have a lightheartedness, I feel like I can sit back and relax. The worst thing that one of them could say is like, we need to get into the air quick because it's such bad weather and you can expect a very turbulent ride, and I've asked the flight attendants to remain seated. It stresses me out so much because I need the flight attendants. The flight attendants are who I stare at to make sure that everything's going to be okay. And I have many flight attendants in my life. I think my parents were my first, if that makes sense, my first people that I looked to make sure that I was safe and to gauge how we were doing. And my younger sister, for sure, has been one of my flight attendants. And probably it's been growing up in the church, it was probably pastors or people in authority I look to often to get that gauge of, am I okay? Am I okay? And so when the flight attendants have to sit down, or when people step out of those roles, or when they disappoint or fail, it can be very, it can be really a scary thing for a six. So I had to text a few people even as I prepared to do this talk, because I needed that sense of, am I okay? Am I doing an okay job? So in continuing with this theme of feeling safe, I try to forecast and control by planning ahead and being prepared for the worst case scenario. This was a theme that came up from the sixes that I asked to share about what it was like for them. I feel a sense of responsibility to keep everyone safe and secure around me. And if you feel safe, then I feel safe. And here's a list of things that make me feel safe. Alarm systems, locks, checking locks, fire alarms, plans, seatbelts, car seats, a well-packed diaper bag, helmets, a full bank account, a full fridge, a clean and organized home, being on time, better even if you're early, driving, and a sense of control. It is hard right now for me because as a six coping with what's going on right now, there's so much unknown, and information was coming in, I felt like almost hourly a few weeks ago, and changing so rapidly that it was near impossible to try to do that contingency planning. And so I felt like for the last few weeks, I've just been spinning and spinning, trying to figure out how to plan or how to prepare. And especially now with just nothing on the calendars and nothing to prepare for, it's been hard to know. I almost feel like a sense of that part of me is not functioning very well. Like, I don't know what to plan for. So this is what one of the sixes wrote about their response to the coronavirus. What if my kid is the first to die in the U.S.? We wouldn't even be able to have a funeral. Then kid number two proceeded to get the cough, and then I did. On day five for me, I either felt or imagined to be short of breath, tried to get tested, but was told to stay home and go to the ER if you can't breathe. My imagination took over, and I could picture, clear as day, the dramatic and detailed end-of-life scenario. It's a real treat to be a six right now.
Well, hey everyone. Excuse the interruption for a quick minute. My name is Kristen. I'm one of the team members here at Eastlake, and we're so glad that you're joining us today on the podcast. It's been so encouraging for us to hear stories from people all over the country and the world who are listening to these messages and resonating with this idea that we just keep saying over and over again, which is life is a gift and love is the point, and that we are all committed to being a beneficial presence in our own community. So thanks for joining us. I hope that that's resonating with you. It's just really fun for us. So wanted to also say thank you to those of you who contribute. This place, all of these things that we do are happening because of people who make consistent, even just small consistent gifts. It helps us plan. It helps us know that there are really people behind us who want this thing to continue. So thank you to those of you who do that. If you haven't had a chance to give yet, I would encourage you to maybe think about doing that if you find this beneficial in your own life. To make a contribution, it's really easy. You can go to eastlakecc.com, and there's a donate button there with all the info. So thanks so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the message.
You might be even just feeling anxious listening to me, especially if you're a six. And if you aren't, then you're probably just feeling really bad for us. So I wanted to include an aspect of the six that is stronger and more powerful, I think, than our fear. And that is our loyalty. So my loyalty to people is stronger than my fear. And this is where my courage thrives. My courage shows up when it's about people. And it's pretty cool because the six is known for their loyalty. And ironically, and it may be hard to believe, but our courage. And my guess, I had to think a lot about where does my courage show up? And I would say that my courage shows up when I'm needing to defend or step in on behalf of someone or just, I guess, in that theme of loyalty. So we will stand by people or systems or beliefs very strongly, sometimes even to a fault, even when it's not in our best interest. It's very difficult for us to let that down because we are just skeptical by nature. So to build trust takes a long time. So once you have it, it's kind of there for life. So I'd love to give some advice to those of you who are in relationship with a six. First of all, during this coronavirus, just craziness, give us some extra space to vent our anxieties, our fears. We might be grasping at anything to try to make some contingency plans, even when there's nothing to plan for. So patience is probably going to be helpful during this time. Number two, in regards to us feeling safe, remember that safety doesn't just mean physical safety. Ask the six in your life, what does safety mean to you? Remember that one of the things that made me feel safe was a well-packed diaper bag. And so it's not always just what you might think of safety. It could be really different for them. For me, if I say to my husband, like, hey, like, let's say I had a trip planned and I was going to be flying somewhere and I say, you know, oh my gosh, I'm so nervous. I think my plane's going to crash and I'll never see my children again. And they're going to grow up without ever knowing me and I won't be at their weddings and graduations. You know, do you think I need to write them all letters before I go? For him, the worst thing he could do would be two things. One would be to actually engage with that idea and be like, yes, let me get you this stationery. So you can write them all letters. Or the other worst thing would be just to completely negate all my feelings and say, like, that's so silly. I can't believe you're even thinking about that. So instead, my advice would be to say something like, you're safe right now. And so are your children. It sounds like you're nervous to fly, and your imagination is taking advantage of that. It's not likely that will happen. It's very helpful to remind a six that they're safe right now in the here and now. So phrases like, you're safe right now. I'm here. If that happens, I'll be here, and we'll walk through that together. It might be going back to what that original question of, you know, what makes your person feel safe, and then encouraging that, you know, maybe it's bringing them a cup of coffee, or it's helping them put into life things that make them feel safe and help them do those more often. So number three, I have realized that sometimes my moods are a projection of not feeling safe and secure in that space or time. So when I'm extra snappy or irritable at my husband, Darren, for how he chooses food, puts the dishes away, breathes, most of the time it's because my fear is buzzing and spinning, and I haven't done myself the favor of turning to look at it and recognize it, maybe talk about it, be aware of it. I haven't helped myself process that in any way. So it could be helpful if you're in a relationship with a six to pause before reacting to their criticism. And say something like, hey, it seems like you may have some worries on your mind. Is there a way I could support you in processing those? Because possibly what they're feeling is a projection onto you, right? And maybe it's something you've discussed before, but you might have a way of helping bring that person into the here and now. So number four, which is could be actually more, this could be something more personal of something that's very helpful for me or to be aware of, I guess, if you're one of my friends. And I'm guessing it's true for some sixes. I'm guessing for some, this would not be true. But I'll just say that it's helpful to have some discretion before sharing news or jarring, sensationalized events that are happening around the world. That we have no personal connection, that you have no personal connection to, or that I have no personal connection to or control over. Because when I hear something that's very random, what I've noticed is other people can just kind of like move on. You know, they hear a sensationalized tragedy and they might talk about it for a minute, but then they've moved on. For me, and my guess is for sixes, we get really stuck and have to do a lot of planning and preparing of how we would never be in that situation, how our friends and family will never be in that situation. And it creates this sense of danger that it's difficult to recover from quickly. So it could really derail a conversation, a dinner, a day even. And that's not to say that we can't handle hard news or hard things, because in fact, going back to that loyalty piece, yes, like we really want to hear and we build our trust that way of sharing probably deep and vulnerable things. And so it's not saying that you shouldn't share what's going on with you, but I'm saying the random one-offs of just random terrible news stories are difficult for me to process quickly, I should say. If it matters to you and if it is something that you deeply care about, then I want to know about it. But if it's not, maybe save it for another time or another conversation. Okay, so if you are a six, I wanted to speak a little bit directly to you. My guess is you've lived as a six, so you've lived with this anxiety or fear most of your life, and perhaps you've learned how to manage it well. You know what makes it worse, and for me, it's social media, it's the news, it's those next door or Ring app notifications that come up. And perhaps you know what makes it better. It could be therapy. It could be medication. It could be meditation. It could be exercise, things like that. I've been curious about what it can help bring a six back to their true self. What is the work that really needs to be done? And I think part of it for me, what I have come to think about is that I need to lean more towards an acceptance and maybe even more of a curiosity about what I fear instead of resisting or freezing in reaction to my fear. So Barbara Brown Taylor is one of my most favorite authors, a woman I look to towards for my own spiritual guidance. She has written a book called Learning to Walk in the Dark, and I really do think she wrote it for all the sixes in the world. She writes about how as kids we've been groomed to be afraid of the dark and view it as something evil and scary and bad. We've obviously kind of been primed for this through movies and TV, things like dark thoughts and dark emotions. In religious or faith-based communities, there's a lot of talk about, you know, good and evil being light and dark, and sin is dark and goodness is light. The sun shines on the good, the darkness consumes the bad. So it makes sense to me that I was scared of dark as a kid, and even now have to, you know, quickly turn on light sometimes. But what is so scary about the darkness? Is it because bad things really do happen more often in the dark? Is it because the darkness is actually bad? And the answer is no. It's because we project onto the darkness our fears and anxieties, making it into something terrifying. Barbara Brown Taylor writes this in her book as well. We are all so busy constructing zones of safety that keep breaking down that we hardly notice where all the suffering is coming from. We keep thinking that the problem is out there, in the things that scare us. Dark nights, dark thoughts, dark guests, dark emotions. If we could just defend ourselves better against those things, we think, then surely we would feel more solid and secure. But of course we are wrong about that, as experience proves again and again. The real problem has far less to do with what is really out there than it does with our resistance to finding out what is really out there. The suffering comes from our reluctance to learn to walk in the dark. For me, to learn to walk in the dark means I need to have courage to stop running and trying to plan my way around what I fear. My contingency planning can be helpful to a point, but it can also be a barrier between me and the ability to learn to be present and grow from my fears. I have found that my anxiety and fear are rarely in the present moment. So practicing and disciplining myself to be more in the here and now is calming and, yes, difficult. So this could be through prayer or a discipline of mindfulness or meditation. It's interesting that a few of the sixes also noted this with what they wrote me. One of them said, "If I dig down deep, I acknowledge honestly that nothing is ever certain, and it compels me to embrace the moment." A few others made similar remarks. So Barbara Brown Taylor also wrote this. The best thing to do when fear has a neck hold on you is to befriend someone who lives in real and constant fear. The best thing to do when you are flattened by despair is to spend time in a community where despair is daily bread. The best thing to do when sadness has your arms twisted behind your back is to sit down with the saddest child you know and say, "Tell me about it. I have all day." The hardest part about doing any of these things is to do them without insisting that your new teachers make you feel better by acting more cheerful when you are around. After years of being taught that the way to deal with painful emotions is to get rid of them, it can take a lot of reschooling to learn to sit with them instead, finding out from those who feel them what they have learned by sleeping in the wilderness. I think it's key. It's allowing ourselves to sit with painful emotions, and for me, it's fear, and to learn from it, allowing it to teach me and show me something perhaps new I didn't know before. So I had mentioned I was going to read you a story, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I wanted to show you, this is one of my most favorite children's books, and it's called Cry Heart But Never Break by Glenn Ringved. And once all of this is, this craziness is over, you should check it out from your library if you are curious. But it's a story about how death, the figure of death, comes to visit a grandma that is dying. Her four grandchildren sit and talk with death, and it's an incredible image for me of what it would be like to sit down with my greatest fear, and instead of resisting or running, to really sit down. And what's so fun about it is Death sits down with these children, and the children pour Death hot black coffee. And I'm just going to read you this one part. It said, finally, Death was ready. He placed his bony hand over his cup to signal no more. Then Leah, who had been watching Death all night, reached out and took his hand. Oh, Death, she said, our grandmother is so dear to us. Why does she have to die? And this is the key part. Some people say Death's heart is as dead and black as the piece of coal. But that's not true. Beneath his inky cloak, Death's heart is as red as the most beautiful sunset and beats with a great love of life. My hope is that you stay healthy and hopeful during this crazy time, and that you don't run from the emotions that arise within, that you're curious about them, that you sit down with them perhaps over a cup of coffee and learn from them. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good day.